meeting people who live in Pittsburgh who are like, I run in the park and I see your piece, or I take my dog out. And so it's like, it really, the more I spend time out here, I realize that lots of people who use this trail and use this park, and they feel a sense of ownership to the park. So thinking about like the public of the park, it was much bigger than I imagined. And it was much more of like, people felt a sense of ownership about the park, which was really, really cool. So,
the water drinkable?
The water, it would need to be filtered. So that's one thing I was also working with the geologist on. And he told me that we looked at studies. So he had a grad student who was studying all the springs, and she tested all the water. And the major contaminants were, can anyone guess?
Dog,
actually.
Oh. And what did you think?
It's actually, it might be lead, but it's basically like from cars, because the road is right above us. Mm-hmm. It's from the brakes, like people putting on their brakes, and it wears down the metal. And so then the metal runs through the soil, through water, washing off. And so that's in the water. The water picks up whatever is around.
Is the reason that it's not clean because it's so close? Is it a factor of distance or depth of the spring? Or because I know there are other springs, mm-hmm. certainly springs up in Maine that we've drank from, that are like the local place to get water.
Yeah.
And tons of people stop and get water there all the time, which is historically,
it's like the best water.
It's so good. Yeah, it feels like a water fountain.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if it's just the urban environment, or if it's, you know, or if there's some measurable percolation factor that it has to go through.
I'm not certain, but I would guess it's the proximity to the road and probably the depth of the spring. Yeah.
Would you encourage people to, like, say, because they have, like, tools where you could, like, filter your own water? So, like, somebody came along and then, like...
Yeah. I would,
If I had my backpack on, if I had brought it, I have a Life straw in there, and we could have sampled. Sorry.
You carry that with you? The Life straw?
I do. I also gave my stepsons ones for their cars.
Wow.
You could have tasted the water.
Yeah.
That would have been cool.
Next time.
So I did. So what's inscribed into the stone says this water isn't safe to drink. Or this water comes from an underground spring. It isn't safe to drink. Use with care. Because I felt like a certain sense of responsibility that by putting this here, it would indicate that it was safe to drink. So I felt the need to add that text. But I'm sure lots of dogs come here and drink this water every day. It's like their spot.
for better or for worse.
I mean, I love the idea that I made a dog drinking fountain, but, you know, I was very inspired by these like public watering holes, like these springs in towns where you could go and it's like plumbed properly and it's like always flowing with water. I love that. And like the non-privatization of water. But I was also looking at these Japanese stone, like these like kind of ritual places for cleansing that are like outside, like in gardens or outside of temples and shrines. So it's like you would approach and then you would either drink some water or you would wash your hands or wash your face before you go in. And yeah, so to me, it's also like that. It's like this space of like contemplation that honors the water.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm taking a mold making class, and Britt today was talking about how one thing you should consider when making sculpture or works is like whether you want the materials to, like, do the materials degrade? Are they meant to last forever? Mm-hmm. So when you're creating like your site specific work, are you thinking about, yeah, the materiality and the time in relation to that? And like, because, you know, this is something that I think will live on for like, you know, past year, I mean, years.
Yeah.
So is that something that you deeply consider?
That came up when I knew I was designing something that was deemed permanent. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that when Alina brought up the point about how everything is rock, right? Everything is rock, like, all over the planet. And when I thought about the idea of a permanent artwork and materiality, I went to rock first. Mm-hmm. And of course, rock changes over time. And we looked at the shale that breaks really easily. That's one kind of rock. But, like, symbolically, rocks represent this kind of permanence, right? Mm-hmm. This stability. And so it was interesting to start with that and then to work with a structural engineer and plan how to move water over a rock. And my goal is that the water will eventually change the shape of the rocks. Mm-hmm. It will probably also, like, water freezing and moving the soil will eventually move them, you know. They are attached to concrete bases, so it will take a lot to move them. It will probably be after my life is over on this planet. Yeah, but
that's pretty short in terms of rock. Like, sandstone and shale are, like, actually really soft.
Yes,
for rock.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And that's interesting to me, yeah. Is, like, to use this rock that is a soft rock.
They used to use it for tombstones, and...
They don't anymore.
They don't, because yeah. All the words disappear.
Yes,
so
yes.
They replaced it mostly with granite now.
Yes, yeah.
I really appreciate it, because, I have an appreciation for it, and, like, this idea of, like, creating works in unity with where we're at, like, you know, environmentally. And maybe that's something that I think down the line, as I continue to work through my own, like, figuring out what is interdisciplinary for me, and, like, mm-hmm. thinking about how a work environment, you know, interacts with an environment, you know, versus just, like, thinking about presentation in a specific space and then taking it away. Like, what does it mean to, like, not even have that institution of a space, like, going out mm-hmm. in the world and creating with that in mind,
mm-hmm. or with the opposite, or yeah. with, like, impermanence in mind too. Yeah. I think that those things in conversation are really cool.
Because I think this is a different level of, like, thinking in an archival way. Coming from, like, a photo background, we're always told, like, mm-hmm. it's a paper archive. Like, what are you using, like, an acid backing wood, and, like, thinking about that. But this is, like, an extension of thinking mm-hmm. about the archival usage of materials.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I will also add too, so at the end of the three stone pieces, the water runs across the trail, and it's a wooden runnel, and that wood is this wood that's called black locust, and that's used to make fence posts that last for hundreds, like, 100+ years. So that also has a long lifespan.
Yeah.
I like that it's for land art. It doesn't do very much intervening. It's sort of more about highlighting the thing mm-hmm. that's already here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, you know, walking up to it because the color really, like, blends into the soil and the leaves, and it has sort of an infrastructural, like, palette, mm-hmm. and it's pretty modest as well.
Mm-hmm.
You might mistake it for a piece of infrastructure
mm-hmm.
until
mm-hmm.
you walk up and you see, like, the letters in a spiral, and
mm-hmm.
and that it's, like, behaving like a fountain.
mm-hmm.
It's also very specifically speaking to that, like, first opening paragraph of the article that talks about gravity as being very site, like, the site specific thing that
yes.
we do, which I kind of love that, though. And I think that there's some of the things that work most effectively for the most people in site specific work are things that are common and related, like, mm-hmm. to your point about infrastructure, right? Like, mm-hmm. having it in conversation with that is actually really relatable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having it not disrupt gravity is actually mm-hmm. really relatable. You know, it's like you said, highlighting.
Yeah. They're the rules that we live by, yeah, that exactly. Our world lives by. Yeah,
exactly. I think, too, it's interesting because I think something that's coming back up, well, not coming back up, but like a conversation that I feel like is approaching all different types of artists is how you consider climate change in your art making.
Which you don't have to, obviously, mm-hmm. right?
But as part of the discourse.
Yeah, it's part of the discourse. But as you know, that becomes a real reality, I think, thinking about installation and land art, like Annie referenced, is something to consider as like a part of an art. Like, obviously, like, you don't have to make that a part of your art practice. But, you know, it's a very real reality. And mm-hmm. so,
yeah.
Like, and should we start considering that?
And actually, I think for landscape architects, there's a lot of like flood plain, yeah. site specific architecture that they put in to manage mm-hmm. flood water in a very similar way to mm-hmm. what this is doing,
mm-hmm. like a retention wall or something like that. Yeah. Yeah,
but the better ones are doing it artistically and not just utility.
I also think Pittsburgh is a unique place to consider that as well, too, given the history of materiality and, like, steel mills and things like that, but then also what this region of the country is situated in that conversation of, like, climate change and, like, the changing landscapes and mm-hmm. things like that. So it'll be interesting to see how, over time, how a lot of these ideas and discourse evolve. You know, maybe mm-hmm. every land artists will come to Pittsburgh because it's like the safe area.
Yeah. What's the maintenance like on this piece?
You know, I think that it literally, this is the most maintenance that it's had mm-hmm. since it was installed. Besides right. like all the installation and like, you know, zhuzhing that happened. Well, one thing that happened is that there was a lot of digging that happened to make the piece, and definitely more than what needed to happen. So that part of the trail got really damaged because the digging, like, basically unleashed these springs that were there. And I tried to compact it back down, but I couldn't do it by hand. So that is one piece, like, repairing that part of the trail is, like, something that has been on my mind since the install. The city said they would do some, like, move some giant rocks over there, but it's like these different entities, like the park is different from the city, and like the park rangers are different from the city public art people. So getting them to agree on what the maintenance is and who's going to do it and who's going to pay for it has been kind of an uphill battle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then it's also like I worked with this engineer to design how the whole thing worked, and he works on like stormwater systems, and he was like, you need to have this this compost sock, and you can see it kind of with the wooden stakes around the edge to protect all of the dirt that's flowing into the stream, because the EPA protects, there's all these regulations to protect waterways. And the installer that I hired was like trying to cut corners, and she was like, we don't need that. And the engineer came to look at the piece after the first day of installation. He's like, where's the compost sock? And I was like, I know. And so I had to like go and get it and bring it myself, and you know, things like that, where it's just like everyone has their own ideas of how to do the job.
Mm-hmm. How like the installation sort of began to be a performance piece about illustrating the bureaucracy that is damaging our environment.
Also site specific.
I feel like I come probably like once a season. Yeah. And I would say the maintenance is mostly like me coming and like cleaning out the leaves, but they are going next level right now. Which is amazing.
I have to get a little of that sound.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
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 Thank you.
volume changed after you installed it? I know it changes, like, based on
seasonally, season, yeah.
But also, like, is that part of, like, what happened with that section, or that was, like, from the digging, like, or it started to, like, put more water into one section, or...
Well, I didn't know... So before the digging happened, all that was here was a big wet spot. Mm. So it was really, I couldn't really see, like, what was the amount of the flow until we put it all together. Mm-hmm. So,
that's so interesting.
So I don't know what it was, what it was like.
It sort of, like, becomes, like, infrastructure for pedestrians and runners because you're redirecting the water away from the path.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think in some ways it did. It was already a very muddy trail because of where it's located. Like, this is kind of one of the lowest points. Mm-hmm. But I think that it got more, I don't know. It's hard to know, like, what part is my own anxiety of making the piece and, like, feeling like I messed something up. I changed the landscape. But yeah.
You know, I mean, like, there's a, it's not mean to.
I don't know, it's just like,
I
empathize with that, but I think you have not caused damage to this site. I guess I'm not a scientist, so
I could just talk to you.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm thinking a little bit about Alina and Belumko's conversation that led to that conversation about those quote-unquote site-specific works at the pyramids. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what you think, how you're thinking through site-specific, you know, relating this and that and your own thoughts.
I don't know if I'm responding to that directly or just site-specificity in general with the last bit of conversation that Annie and Ginger were having, but, like, changing the environment and stuff. Like, we were walking by and there was a lot of tarp, so, like, all of it is changed and managed, but then there's an illusion that parks are not.
Yes.
Right? And then deserts are not mingled with, but every place is mingled with. Mm-hmm. And pieces like this, or like the pyramids, they just make it obvious that we're everywhere, like, our species is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is no pristine.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, we can't get back.
Yeah. This is landscaped. It's a combination of human and nature, mm-hmm. but it's, yeah, we walked over all those bridges, mm-hmm. right? Like, there are paths everywhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is definitely had human hands in its design. Mm-hmm. So,
but that's true of so much of the U.S. in general. I mean, mm-hmm. whole forests that were farmland that are now forests again, where the trees are only 100 years old.
Mm-hmm. I guess, like, the sort of thing that we pay attention to is, like, how can we maintain it for who's here now and be as, like, non-destructive as possible?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Moving forward.
But, like, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Do no harm.
I feel like we should head back because it's getting dark.
Yeah.
How do you all feel?
Yeah, we didn't bring our headlamps.
I know.
We have flashlights on
and our lights draw.
And our lights
draw. Okay, so we can walk back when we can, or we can go a little bit further down and loop up and walk on that upper trail. Does anyone have a preference? Go back this way?
Which one is the safest? I just asked.
Because
it's going to... Okay, then let's do that.
I think we go that way because it's getting darker.
Yeah.
Have you ever camped before, Alina?
I've not.
It's kind of fun.
What is that?
It's like camping.
Well, I mean, I'm going to that just by the word I'm so
it's like dark.
But did you have a cap?
You go back into warmth.
Or we can go up to Morgan summer house.
I don't know if that's
Yeah, and the personal development itself is the shortcut to success. That's how my enthusiast thinks. But yeah, it's really cool. Thank you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
You're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT 88.3 FM. Today, we're going to be talking to Maxwell Jones, PhD student in the Computer Science Department at Carnegie Mellon University, about AI. Thanks for coming on the show, Max.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Arjun. I'm super excited to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I started my undergrad at CMU, actually, Carnegie Mellon, doing an AI major. So I was in the computer science department doing an AI major, and I also actually did an additional math major. After that, I did a master's in machine learning in the machine learning department at CMU, which was super fun. So I guess for my master's work, I did some research on style transfer with generative models for images. So this is like, you can think of generating an image, and you want to generate an image in a certain style. And so the problem was kind of some specific version of that. During undergrad, I did some research as well. Not as much, but I did some theoretical machine learning research because I liked math. So I thought maybe I would like some theory. I ended up not liking it as much, but it ended up being cool. And I also did some fairness and bias research during undergrad. So you can think of like, you know, after a model is trained, you know, does it work the same on people of different races? What kind of correlations are there between captions outputted by a model and biases that humans have or biases that might be in the data? So after that, I started a PhD in the School of Computer Science, actually in the machine learning department. But I'm co-advised by one advisor in the machine learning department. So it's like Ruslan. He is like a super well-known, well-respected person in machine learning. He invented some of the seminal work in machine learning. So his PhD advisor was Geoffrey Hinton, who's like very well known and like just got a Nobel Prize recently. So that's exciting. And I'm also co-advised with Junyan Zhu, who's in the Robotics Institute. And he does more generative model stuff. So I worked with him during my master's. And I guess now I'm kind of interested in sequential decision making or agentic processes for vision, creative tasks, and I guess my long-term plan is to work in some video editing. So how can we make video editing easier for creators? How can we create tools to kind of be a prayer programmer or to help creators make cool stuff with videos? So, yeah.
Sure, that's really cool stuff. So all of the new talk these days has been about large language models like ChatGPT, and now the news about DeepSeek. Could you give a quick explanation to the audience on sort of how large language models work for the layman?
Yeah, sure. So I guess at their core, they take in words, right? Like I'll say, I don't know, what team did Michael Jordan play on when he was playing basketball? And so it takes in a sequence of words. And then it outputs a sequence of words. So this example could be like, maybe it'll output, oh, Michael Jordan played basketball for the Chicago Bulls. And maybe it'll even give you more information like, you know, he played in predominantly in the 90s where he won 6 championships. From an input-output standpoint, that's what's going on. And then like more formally, you kind of have some neural network, which is really just like a large set of numbers, weights, whatever you want to say. It's a function that takes in these words, transforms them into numbers, into vectors, and then does a bunch of operations on them, and then outputs the words. And so I guess there's all this talk of training. Basically, how like a large language model is trained is you just get sequences of words from somewhere. So typically this is like from the internet, and then you train the model to be able to predict the sequences of words that you've seen so far. Right, so maybe on the internet, there's sequences of words like, oh, you know, what was Michael Jordan's favorite game to play? Well, he loved playing basketball. Maybe you train on that data. And I guess nowadays, the large part of large language models comes from the fact that you're training on whatever millions, billions, even like a trillion like words or tokens, which is like a kind of small building block that a word is made out of to the model.
Thanks for that explanation. So over the past couple of years, LLMs, ChatGPT, and generative AI in general, kind of like some of those generative image models that you were talking about earlier, have really come into vogue in the mainstream media, and everyone's hearing about it, and there seems to be a lot of investment dollars and work going into it.
Yeah.
But machine learning as a discipline has existed for decades now.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the factors that you think have created this shift or explosion in interest in machine learning more broadly as well as technical innovations that you think kind of led us here? What are the most important ones?
So there's kind of two things. So the first is like ease of use. So I think ChatGPT was a big watershed moment for generative AI, as a lot of people will say. And one of the main things is because anyone could use it for free on their computer. Right? So it didn't require a special hardware, or you'd kind of have research machines to run the like neural networks or run the machine learning models. All you had to do was log into a website and then type something, and something would come back. Right? And so that's kind of what led to many millions of people trying it out for the first time. And I think that's what led to like people investing, saying, oh, this can be very useful. Because people started to notice that, you know, ChatGPT knew about so much stuff. It knew about whatever use case they were trying to work on. And so then from, a more technical side, one of the main innovations with ChatGPT over previous large language models is this like idea of RLHF, or reinforcement learning for human feedback. And so without going into too much depth, I think the main idea here is that you don't only want to kind of reconstruct things you've seen online, but you kind of want to pick something that you think a human is really asking you about. So I guess the example that I like to go to for something like this is, let's say I train on a bunch of workbooks and a bunch of text from the internet. That's not a workbook, right? So maybe a workbook has questions like, oh, what is the capital of the United States? Followed by, oh, what is the capital of France? And maybe other things have words like, what is the capital of the United States? Followed by Washington, D.C. And so as a user, if I input in ChatGPT, what is the capital of the United States? I want it to give me the answer, Washington, D.C. But the training data might say, well, it's equally likely to predict what is the capital of France as the next line, because it's seen those two lines next to each other a lot in the training data. So this idea of reinforcement learning with human feedback is saying, well, actually, you should really output Washington, D.C. in these examples, because you should kind of have an idea. You should learn what humans are looking for. And so there was kind of some seminal work in that domain that really made ChatGPT super good.
Yeah, so there's a lot of talk about resource consumption with AI and how mm-hmm. that's going to be a growing concern as time goes on. And obviously, NVIDIA has become one of the world's largest companies off the back of powering AI training and inference. Can you explain to the audience a little bit why it requires such massive computing resources to run these models, and why these resources are so specialized to companies like NVIDIA?
So I guess, yeah, there's two questions. One is, why does it require so much resources? And so one of the things that like the AI community has found in the last 10 years is that the way to have a better model is to have a bigger model trained on more data. So if you want to have a general model that can do a lot of stuff, the best way to achieve that is by getting a lot of high quality data and training a very large model. And so improvements in the field of large language models, or just general models in general, which is what like a normal user wants to use, like a general model that can do a lot of stuff, then the best thing they do is make a bigger and bigger model that's trained with more and more data. And so as you get bigger and bigger models, right, the cost of consumption goes up. And so it's actually one thing that's important to note here is that the training of the model isn't actually like the majority of the bulk of the consumption. What's the bulk of the consumption is users querying the model, you know, millions or hundreds of millions of times, whereas you only have to train the model once. So I think that's basically the real reason. And then this NVIDIA question is kind of a separate question. So they have like the best like GPUs, graphical processing units that people can buy. And that's like a chip that you use to train a model. And so because they have the best things to use to train the model, and everyone wants to train the model, then they're super rich, right? So their main customer isn't like the layperson, like you or me or anyone who's trying to use these models. It's like OpenAI or Meta or other companies that are trying to train models at a very, very large scale who need to buy these in bulk, right? And they're like pretty expensive per graphical processing unit or GPU.
Cool. So one of the things that's been in the news a lot recently is DeepSeek, and I know you've looked into it yourself a little mm-hmm. bit. Can you explain what the hubbub was about with DeepSeek? Why was it such big news that they came out with their model?
So I guess, like, just going from what we were talking about before, like OpenAI has this, they have their ChatGPT, which everyone uses, which a lot of people use, which is like super valuable. And they've raised a lot of money, right? And when they talk to investors, they say, hey, we need all this money because training is super expensive, GPUs are very expensive, and the more money we have, the better we can train. We can hire good people to train our models, right? We can hire smart people to train our models. And so we need all this money, right? And then Meta and all these companies that are buying NVIDIA chips are saying, hey, we need all this money in order to train our models so we can have the best model. The assumption is, hey, you give us all this money now, we'll train our models, and then in the future, you're going to get your profits back because we're going to have these models and everyone's going to use them and there's going to be some pay structure and somehow you're going to get your money back. So DeepSeek was a model trained by this like DeepSeek team in China. It's like a quantitative firm. They do some large language model training also. So like the large language model isn't their profit structure. It's more about like, you know, doing stuff in the market, some kind of financial math stuff. And so they trained a model, which they open sourced. So that means like not only can you use it like via a website, like the actual weights themselves are online. So anyone could download the model in theory and run it kind of either not locally, but they could run it without having to pay DeepSeek at all because they have the weights. And so they trained this model, released it, open sourced it, so anyone could in theory download the weights. And it was on par or almost on par with the top models from like these US companies, so like OpenAI. I think the Meta model is not quite as good as the OpenAI model, or Google has a good model as well. And so I think the scare was, if we give these companies all this money, however, like another company could train a model that's just as good or basically indistinguishable that people could use for free, then kind of where's the profit coming back? So I think about this as a reason for like all the big market hubbub, as opposed to, oh, it only costed X dollars to train the model. So I think something that a lot of people talk about is, oh, it only costs whatever, $5 million to train this DeepSeek model, whereas OpenAI kind of, you know, has asked for so much money. Right? But I think one thing that's good to separate is like the cost of training a model from the cost of the research and development to know how to train the model correctly, and the cost of trying a lot of stuff out before you do your final single training run. Right? So this cost of research and development and figuring out, you know, what the best model looks like, how to get the best data, how to clean the best data, right? That's where like all the costs are, as opposed to a single training a single model, right? So I think something I like to think about is, you know, they're a kind of a quantitative finance company, right? So maybe, and the paper itself had like whatever 40 or 50 people on it, right? So you can think, and they've been working on this kind of direction of machine learning for 4 or 5 years, right? So in the US, how much would the salary of 40 or 50 quantitative research finance people over 4 or 5 years cost? It's a lot of money, right? 40 people times 4 years times salaries north of $500K to $1 million to $2 million for a senior quantitative research person. So it's not as if this entire process costs $5 million. It costs significantly more, right? But even with that being said, there's still a question of, is this monetizable if there's always a free version of the top model, right? So that's still a question.
Interesting. So you would think that the human capital is like a pretty significant portion.
Yeah, that's the main portion of it, is the human capital and also the capital needed to train different testing runs, right? So when I look at the DeepSeek model and I look at their tech report, like every single part of the process is clearly, to me, optimized very thoroughly, and many things are tested. Right, so maybe let's say, I'll just say a number, there's 50 different things you could have tested, right? They've tested all of those and figured out what works better than previous things for a lot of different parts. So that process of even testing those things, just the money to train different versions, is going to cost whatever, 10x, 100x, the 5 million used for the final training.
Sure. You talked about open source models, and yeah, obviously DeepSeek V3 and R1 are open source models, mm-hmm, where the weights are publicly available. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as an increasing trend in AI, and what are some of the impacts of having these large models open sourced?
So this is actually a good question. And so the head of the machine learning department is Zico Coulter, and he's one of the board members for OpenAI. So I think he had some interesting takes about open source versus closed source as well. So I guess there are some companies that swear by open source, some companies that basically like only do closed source. So an example is like these DeepSeek, all of their model weights are open, right? Meta, all of the model weights are open. Right? OpenAI, no model weights are open. But at the same time, there's kind of a continuum of open source, right? So maybe on the completely closed end, right, is something like OpenAI, where all you can do is input text and output it, the model will output something. You don't know how big it is. You don't know how many weights there were. You don't know what it was trained on. You don't know anything about it. Right? A little bit farther down this kind of trajectory is like a meta model or a DeepSeek model where they'll give you the weights, but they won't tell you what training data was used to train the model. Right? And they'll give you a paper saying, hey, these are all the things we did. Right? But they'll say the data set contained this many words, but we're not going to tell you where it came from. Right, so this also isn't actually fully reproducible, right? Because you don't actually have the data that they used. And then on the other end is kind of something that's completely open. And so completely open, I think, there's some examples. I think the Allen Institute for AI has some completely open stuff, where that means they tell you the data set, you know, they tell you what the model looks like, they give you the model weights, and they write a tech report about everything that happened, as well as all their failures, and given that information, you have enough information to perfectly reproduce their model, right? So you should ideally be able to get up to some level of error, like the error, like the exact same weights or very similar weights. Right? So when people say DeepSeek is open, it's definitely more open than an OpenAI model, but it's not open in the sense that given the DeepSeek paper and infinite money, someone could reproduce their model exactly because the data is not released.
Interesting. Just a reminder, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Arjun Das, here with Maxwell Jones, AI researcher at CMU. Speaking of CMU, obviously a lot of really cool ML research happens here that you're aware of. What are some cool research or researchers that you would like to shout out as being particularly interesting at the moment?
So I guess I first want to shout out, I think my lab members are doing some really cool stuff. First, Shengyu Wang, who is working on data attribution. So this is actually a very hard problem. The idea is, let's say I trained my image generator on 5 billion images from the internet. And then I say, hey, generate me an image of a cat wearing a top hat. And I have some, and I get some cat wearing a top hat. But the question is, can I figure out which of those training images were very influential into making that cat with a top hat? And I guess the main idea is, if I know that, then maybe I can give those artists some residual pay, right? So you can think of an artist opts into getting trained to using their data to train with a model. And then from there, if the model generates an image that was based upon their work, they get some residual fee, right? This is actually an incredibly difficult problem from a mathematical and machine learning perspective. So Shengyu is doing some really cool work. I think also Gaurav Parmar and Nupur Kumari are doing some really cool stuff in the field of image translation and customization. So image translation is like, say you have an image of a car during the day. Can I turn it into an image of a car, like raining, right? Or can I turn it into an image of a car when it's cloudy outside? And so one application of this is like data augmentation for self-driving, right? So I guess more concretely, if I have a bunch of self-driving videos from the day, it'd be cool if I could generate self-driving videos during rain, so I can use that to train to make a very strong self-driving car that I think will work in all cases. And then customization is kind of the idea of, I have some personal images. Maybe I have some photos of myself. Maybe I have some selfies of myself. And then I want to generate like a high resolution professional headshot of myself, right? And so in this case, I'm only giving the model 5 to 10 images of myself, as opposed to whatever it was trained on, like billions of images. And then can it use that kind of scarce data and its general knowledge about humans to then output a photo of me, but like say in a professional suit and in a headshot?
A lot of really neat stuff. Thanks. So speaking of these generative image and video models that you and your lab are working on, what do you see as some of the important implications in the future and potential uses? Obviously, it's hard to know exactly what's going to happen in the future, but where do you see the impact of this work?
So I think there's a few things. So what I think there's kind of two areas that this technology can be very useful. And I think it's maybe a little bit different than what people think. So when people think of like, oh, I have like an image generation tool, they think of like, oh, like it's very negative. It's usually from a very negative connotation of, oh, it's going to replace someone. And so I think of it more as like someone with these tools can generate cool stuff much faster and can iterate on stuff much faster. So I'll give you two examples of like an expert with these tools being able to iterate much faster in the movie world, right? So first, like the movie Into the Spider-Verse, right? There was experts on the team that was like kind of designing, and they had AI tools that they could use to speed up their design process, to try things faster. And so to me, the result of this kind of technology is that experts can make a high quality movie faster, right? So we don't have to wait whatever 6 years for the next Into the Spider-Verse movie, which no one would like to do. We'd like to have a really high quality version in 3 years, right? That's as high quality as a version in 6 years without the technology. Right, so I kind of think of it as a continuation of any image editing software, in some sense, where it speeds up the use for creators. Another use case is helping people who are typically non-creators create high-quality stuff that they can be proud of and learn more quickly. Right, so one example for me is, like, in the future, I'd love to make more YouTube videos, right? But some software like Adobe Premiere Pro or other video editing software is very... There's a lot of different tools you could use. It's very cumbersome, right? So it would be good if, like, AI could help me as a creator or someone that wants to be a creator create very high-quality videos, like, immediately without all the overhead, right? Or could help me learn more quickly what a good quality video looks like. So I think this is another use case, is kind of helping people who are not in the space or who want to get in the space, like, create things more quickly.
You speak of generative AI almost as like a force multiplier, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah, something like that. And there's also like 3D assets or gaming is also another example that's kind of along these similar lines.
Yeah, so for our listeners who aren't machine learning researchers at CMU, mm-hmm. But still want to use AI for positive impact in their own work, what are some ways that they can go about learning how to use these tools to boost their output?
That's a good question. So there's... a few things, I guess. So first of all, the internet is a great tool. So you can look up stuff. Nowadays, if I want to learn about something, I don't know that much about it and I can't find it like via Google search, I'll just ask ChatGPT, like, hey, I want to learn more about X thing. What are a set of things I should look up? Also, there's different AI tooling, especially in the generative AI space that's more accessible, that doesn't require super fancy hardware. So for example, a tool might be like Comfy UI is a tool. It's like a user interface for kind of using these models. So I think that has like a relatively low barrier to entry as opposed to like trying to code up something fancy.
Sure. In general, what are some tasks that you see AI being really good at? And what are some tasks where it really still has some room to go?
So I guess... And I was talking with some other like PhD friends about this. It seems like tasks where you're kind of just sitting around and like doing something on a computer like should be very automatable, especially kind of tasks that are not super long term, where you're kind of sitting down and like typing or doing something that doesn't require any like interaction with the real world as much. So one example might be like writing reports, like writing write-ups. Any write-up where what you're doing is kind of looking things up online, synthesizing information, writing things up in a certain format that's very nice, I think AI could be very good at. Right? Another example might be, in the coding world, might be kind of fixing a single error in like a coding library or like some kind of repository. I think that kind of task AI can be and will be very good at. Right? All these tasks are... in some ways still kind of short term in the sense that you don't have to do stuff for a very long time. So some things that AI in general is bad at is just anything in the real world. Right? So robotics as a field hasn't hit its kind of ChatGPT moment, as some researchers like to say, where it's very widely adopted and everyone is kind of using kind of generalist robots. Right? And so the reason for that is just manipulating things in the real world is just harder. Right? It's harder to iterate. It's harder to test a robot 10 times than it is to test some code 10 times. It's just fundamentally harder, takes longer. So I think that's an area where AI still has a long way to go. And then another area where AI might have a long way to go is kind of long horizon tasks, right? So I think one example is AI can perfectly pass maybe a job interview for coding where you're asked two very short questions. But can AI perform like a long-term like intern? Maybe this is more unclear. Right. And so I think people are working towards kind of this direction. But anything where there's super, super long like content that you have to create, I think is like much more difficult. Yeah, there's some types of things that AI I think might be like not as good at in kind of the social, like human aspect. So maybe like being able to synthesize new memes or something. Like something that's like you have to be really in tune with the culture to do. But I could eat my words on that one. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Watch out for the new meme AI model dropping in 2025,
right? Oh, God. Well, I guess we'll see. People will definitely try.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to come soon, if it hasn't already.
Yeah, I know there's like YouTube creators that just do like they do video essays where they like synthesize the video and like the and the script with AI. And so that's kind of, I don't know, I like a use case where you have thoughts as a human and then you use AI as a mode to try to, you know, get them out there more quickly.
Yeah.
Or iterate on them more quickly, yeah.
Yeah, I remember hearing a really interesting perspective on what AI is good at and bad at, that things that are like really easy or instinctual for humans actually end up being the things that AI is bad at.
Yeah, like, it's weird.
You could teach a 5-year-old to catch a ball, but to teach a robot like how to move its motors to like, I don't know, play hockey or something is like very difficult. But you see little kids playing hockey everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those things. I think I forgot who it was. Maybe Ilya or some big AI mogul said it has like this kind of jagged intelligence, where the point is it can do highly intelligent things, but it still cannot do very simple things. So like it learns in a different way than humans are used to, in the sense that it can do very complicated things while still failing to do very simple things, right? And so then the question is, how can you augment an AI to know when that's the case, or to deal with that, or kind of to not have to do that kind of thing? So one example might be like multiplication, right? Like, you can make an AI that knows a lot of stuff, but then still maybe struggles with 10-digit multiplication. Right? But if the AI says, hey, you gave me a 10-digit multiplication question, let me just use a calculator, like, maybe you can kind of patch some of these issues.
So as AI has been in the popular mind for a few years now, more so than ever before, do you think it's here to stay in terms of how people think about it, or do you think this sort of initial burst of attention is going to go away?
I don't know. I think it's here to stay, and it's easy for me to say that as someone who works in the field, but especially after talking to like other people who aren't in the field or are even in high-ranking roles at CMU or other places where you'd expect them to be more likely to say that it's not here to stay. I think everyone thinks it's here to stay. And maybe the reason is that, especially this generative AI stuff, it's so easy to use and it can give so much value that value will kind of like circumcede any attempts to completely like stop it, is in my opinion. I think there's so much value that it can be output to make people's lives easier that people will just continue to use it. And whether the people think about it differently is another question. But I think there's a lot of value in people continuing to use this tool. But one thing I will say is with humans in general, like, we go through cycles of having super cool new technology or something that's super cool and new, not knowing how to use it. And then after we know how